Forgive me. Thanks. I shouldn't be late. I lost all the things that are my strengths, and so I have to regain them again, I guess. I'm not sure how to do that. I didn't lose all the things that are my strengths. I shouldn't say that. I just lost most of them. And I don't mean that in the sense of being self-pity. I just mean I feel like I need to explain that to you. Okay. Thanks. There's a lot of people that had that happen to them. Well, it is good. It's good for a while, to learn certain things. But I miss some of them. Okay. We're talking about martyrs in England, heading toward the period of the Reformation. And I gave you a list of a couple of them. We talked about William Sowtry and John Babdy. And now we're on Sir John Oldcastle, who sat in Parliament as a lord. And we left him having been judged as a heretic, and priests were trying to reduce his spirits, and he gave a good defense for himself, and he was condemned to death, and he knelt and he prayed for his enemies, and he was led back to the castle. But before his execution, he escaped. And this is where we left off. Now, rumors of conspiracies were circulated by priests. They said the Lollards conspired to let this man out of prison. And the king was alarmed. And so 40 Lollards were arrested, put on trial, and executed by the civil government of England. And a new violent law was enacted against the Lollards. The government was afraid Oldcastle would lead the Lollards, and 1,000 marks were offered for his arrest. Oldcastle had fled to Wales, and he lived there and preached the gospel. 3 years later, though, he was captured, and he was dragged on a hurdle, which is a wooden frame. They tied him to it and dragged him along the ground. Back to England to his execution, and he was suspended on gallows, hung by his neck on a rope, but without dying, and he was hung over a slow fire and burned to death slowly. Before his execution, though, he fell on his knees and implored the forgiveness of his enemies. Now, this was a mistake. It's one thing to ask God to forgive them, for they know not what they do, but that's not what he did. He asked them to forgive him for his behavior, and this is a mistake. He shouldn't have done this. It shows, though, that a principle of praying audibly before everyone, if you're going to die in the next 5 minutes, it really doesn't matter anyway, what people think of you or anything like that, so you might as well go all out. Yeah. And that's what he did, praying out loud to God, before he died. And he stood and addressed the multitude to follow God and not these false teachers. He refused the service of a priest, too. They asked him if he wanted to take communion before he died. And by that, they meant Roman Catholic Mass. And so they had the host and the wine there, and he refused this. Multitudes wept for Sir John Oldcastle, and they prayed for him, and they loved him. Priests were affirmed, though, that he was suffering as a heretic, but the people believed in him. In fact, the last words recorded of Sir John Oldcastle through the flames were, quote, "Praise God," and he died. And so he was burned to death. One of the most remarkable facts, though, uncovered by history, is that morning, as the archbishop unrolled the death scroll and read the sentence of death, his throat was seized with a malady. He began choking, and he couldn't finish reading it. They took him inside, and he died that afternoon. Now, we view this as the judgment of God upon this man for killing Sir John Oldcastle. The next archbishop also moved against the Christians in England, and he also died a terrible death. Okay, did you have a question?
Mm-hmm. that situation, would it still be wrong to...
No, if you behaved wrongly, you should apologize for your wrong behavior. Sure. But I don't think that's what he was doing, to the best of my knowledge. I think he was asking them, you know, I've offended your laws and I've done wrongly from what you wanted me to do and I'm sorry. And it's just, you know, there are some people like this. They're so good-hearted that they act wrongly, you know. They take all the blame on themselves and everything all the time when it isn't even their fault and that kind of thing. You know, and he seems to be that kind of a man to me. And there's a, you know, there's a time to take all the blame on yourself even when it isn't your fault. But there's also a truth of standing up for what's right and fair and reasonable. I think he's making a mistake here, but I do agree with you. You know, if in the flesh, if this happened to one of us, and in the flesh somebody struck out and hit the guy or something, boy, he should apologize for that. That's wrong, you know. Okay. Sure. I don't know. I don't know what he apologized for. So.
I'm glad he escaped. I think
that was right. Yeah, I'm glad he escaped too. Gave him 3 more years to preach the gospel. Okay, now the next point I want to cover is this. It's called the Western Schism. S-C-H-I-S-M. The Western Schism. Now, tape students, pick up file 8 in the Bible College Library. We should go down and get this file. I meant to bring it with me today. Let's see. Can somebody run down there and get it? One of you here? You get it for me, Craig? You'll have to use my key to get into the college office and ask them for Church History File 8.
So someone is in there?
Well, if they're not, you'll just have to come back. Okay? And we'll hand it out next week. The Western Schism refers to a brief period, 1378 to 1417, during which the Roman Catholic Church was divided between 2 and then 3 rival popes. The Western Schism is a brief period, 1378 to 1417, during which the Roman Catholic Church was divided by allegiance between 2 and then 3 simultaneous and rival popes. Now you'll remember we distinguish this from what we call in history the Great Schism. Who remembers what the Great Schism is?
Is that
869 or the Eastern Catholic Church split from the Western Catholic Church. That's a bigger event because it's more worldwide. This is an event within the Catholic Church, so it's called the Western Schism because you have the Eastern Catholic Church and the Western Catholic Church, or the Roman Catholic Church. This is within the Western half. It's the schism in the West, in the Roman half. Now, sometimes they call this in history the Great Schism. So you will find that name for this event in history. But because this larger breach between the East and West, an unrelated event dated 869 or 1054, is also called the Great Schism, it's generally agreed we should call this period of competing pontiffs the Western Schism. So that's what we're going to call it. this movement of different popes was solved by what's called the conciliar movement. C-O-N-C-I-L-I-A-R, the conciliar movement. Excuse me. The conciliar movement was an attempt to make the Pope subject to the decisions of a council. You can see the word council in the name conciliar, so it means the movement with regard to church councils. And the Catholic Church attempted to make the Pope submit to whatever a church council decided. So that would mean the unanimous decision of 100 bishops could outweigh the Pope. Now, it was attempted then to have this conciliar movement solve the problem. You see, you had all these popes, and then they figured, well, let's call a church council. We'll get all the bishops together. They'll vote who the real pope is, and we'll make that pope resign, and we'll appoint a new pope. Now, you see, if the pope is over the church council, then he could reject that. You follow that? He could say, well, I don't agree. I'm still pope. And they'd say, no, you're not. And he'd say, yes, I am. And then he'd be in one of these arguments like kids have again. You know? Where the kid goes, uh-huh. You know, it's one of those things again. And these things are in the flesh. And so this movement failed. The conciliar movement did not solve the problem. They tried it, but it didn't work. Okay. So look at page 1 of file 8, and we'll talk about it here. The Western Schism refers to a brief period following the Pope's Avignon residency. Avignon is a city in France. It's right here in southern France. During which Western Christendom was divided by allegiance between 2 and then 3 simultaneous and rival popes. Next paragraph. The conciliar movement offered a means of resolving the schism, but failed. An attempt was made at the Council of Pisa to unite the church under one newly elected pope, but this also failed. Finally, in 1417, at the Council of Constance, the 3 existing rival popes resigned or were deposed, and Martin V was elected Pope of Rome, ending the Western Schism. So this is an event that happens right around 1400, okay, which is where we are in history now, in the pre-Reformation movement. So this fact and event fits in here. Now, to lead up to this, we need to learn about the Babylonian captivity of the papacy. A primary factor contributing to the schism was the so-called, quote, Babylonian captivity of the papacy. Italian patriots such as Dante and Petrarch used the metaphor to infer that the Roman pontiffs who moved their residency to France during the roughly 70 years were captives of the French kings, 2 Kings 24 and 25. Remember how the kings of Israel were captured by the Babylonians, and the Babylonians told them what to do? They made them by power subject unto them. And so these writers were saying, when the Pope's residency moved from Rome to France and they were electing French bishops to be Pope, these popes were under the control of the French king. And the king told them what to do. And so that's why this metaphor happened. Also because it lasted about 70 years. And so it's kind of like the Babylonian captivity. Some writers say the popes at Avignon were not subject to the French crown, but the common evangelical view is the papacy was run by the French court. During this period, there were no popes at Rome. Remember that, for 70 years. The one uncontested pontiff dwelt in France. 7 French popes ruled successively in Avignon. Clement V, who was crowned in 1305 at Lyon in the presence of the French king, established the papal residence at Avignon. Due to strife in Rome, he resided in various cities of France until he settled in Avignon. His successors remained in France because of constant disorder in Italy. The French court influenced them, but the popes were not mere puppets, as some have alleged. Some charges of corruption during this period are true, especially regarding financial cunning. After much preparation, Gregory XI took the papacy back in 1377. His death was followed by the Western Schism. Okay, here we go, Western Schism. During the residency of the papacy in France, there were no rival claimants to the papacy. The one recognized pope had merely moved from Rome to France. As noted already, Gregory XI moved the papal see back to Rome in 1377. Unable to settle the disturbances there, he considered returning to Avignon, but died, and was replaced by Urban VI. Page 2. The Western Schism began shortly after the election of this new pope. didn't see the guy before him had actually lived in France and been Pope in France, and he moved to Rome. 4 months after electing Urban as Pope of Rome, a group of French cardinals rescinded their choice, seceded from Rome, and elected Clement VII as rival Pope at Avignon. Okay? So, remember, the cardinals vote who is Pope. These cardinals voted for this man, Urban. But then they decided, we don't want Urban. So they say, we rescind, or we take back our vote. And that a group of French cardinals elected their own Pope. And they said, Clement VII is the real Pope, and he's reigning at Avignon. This was the beginning of the Western Schism, which saw the rise of two and eventually three competing lines of popes, each excommunicating one another. Clement VII had been a legate of Gregory XI in Italy. While reigning at Avignon, Clement VII refused all orders of mediation to solve the schism and returned to one uncontested pope. Urban, meanwhile, still claimed to be the real pope. For the next 39 years, until the end of the schism, there was always at least two men who claimed to be Pope of the Roman Catholic Church at the same time. The Greek Orthodox Church was not involved, so the schism is called the Western Schism. The Roman Catholic Church today recognizes only the popes who ruled at Rome as true popes during the schism. The pretenders at Avignon and Bologna are referred to as antipopes. Conciliar movement. Conciliarism was a reform movement in the 14th to 15th centuries that sought to make the Pope subject to the decisions of a general council. The movement resulted from clergy finding difficulty in reconciling the increasing claims of papal authority with a theoretical possibility of a heretical Pope. See, that's theoretical, isn't it? You know, we say it's actual. They say it's theoretical, but, you know, from their view, what if the Pope is a heretic? You know, if everybody is subject under the Pope and he decides to become an Arian or a Monarchian or something, then all he has to do is say that and it changes all the Catholic doctrine and all the Catholics in the whole world can't believe in the Trinity anymore. What if he speaks in tongues? What if he becomes a Buddhist? You know? Well, he's infallible on matters of faith. So, you know, there's a problem here. The Western Schism in 1378 raised the question of the supremacy of authority. Some argued that since there was not just one recognized pope, the duty of convoking a general council fell to the cardinals. The Council of Constance ended the Western Schism. Consequently, the conciliar movement declined from then, since the movement was no longer necessary once the authority of one supreme pope was generally accepted again. Okay, Council of Pisa. Here's what they did to try to solve the problem when they had several popes reigning at once. The Council of Pisa was convoked in 1409 by cardinals in order to end the Western Schism that had divided Christendom since 1378. After declaring itself canonically convoked and ecumenical, the council deposed both of the two rival popes as schismatic and heretical. The deposed popes are Gregory XII at Rome and Benedict XIII at Avignon. The council then elected Alexander V to be the one true pope. He promised to reform the church and then officially dissolve the council, taking papal residence at Bologna. Now, Bologna is a city in northern Italy. Here's Rome, and here's Bologna. So it's way up here in the north. North central Italy. Although Alexander V was unanimously elected to fill the presumably vacant papal chair, the two existing claimants refused to recognize the council's decision, and both still claimed to be pope. Now there were three popes instead of just two. The Council of Pisa did not end the Western Schism. It became worse than before, due to the addition of a third pope. However, it is generally admitted that the addition of a third pope paved the way for the final solution found at the Council of Constance. So, what happened at the Council of Pisa was these bishops, or cardinals, got together. They called their own church council. And they said, we're going to elect a new pope and depose the other two. So they did, and the other two just stayed right there anyway. Council of Constance.
Yes?
Yes?
You know, it seems that if three gods could work, why couldn't three popes work? You
know? I don't know. Might be a type. Okay. Three men and one pope. One papacy. You got one papacy in three persons. No? Which is what they... Okay. Following the election of Alexander V at the Council of Pisa in 1409, there were three rival popes. Alexander, this new third pope, suddenly died. And John the 23rd was elected to succeed him at Bologna. That still left three popes. John the 23rd, who was in military trouble, reluctantly agreed to convoke the Council of Constance to secure the help of the Holy Roman Emperor, Sigismund. The emperor also wished to call a council to enhance his prestige, reform the church, and suppress heresy. It was John the 23rd, the Bologna Pope, who actually called the council. The council commenced November 5, 1414, and was structured according to nations: Italy, France, Germany, England, and Spain. Each nation held its own presidency and an equal vote, thus eliminating an overbalance of Italian votes. And we say, good for you. If we said, okay, every bishop gets one vote. Okay, well, you have 400 bishops from Italy, you know, and 38 bishops from here, and 20 bishops from here, and 10 bishops from here, and 5 bishops from here. Guess what kind of a nationality of man is going to be pope? An Italian. So they said, no. Each country gets one vote. Italy gets one vote, France gets one vote, Germany gets one vote, etc. In 1415, John the 23rd offered to resign if his rivals would resign. He then fled from the council. Now, he called the council, you know, but he fled. The emperor held it together. John was brought back to the council. Heretical and deposed. Removing Pisa's pope from Bologna left two popes to be dealt with by the council. That's kind of an interesting thing, isn't it? John the 23rd calls the council. He gets scared and he runs away. They arrest him and bring him back and depose him. He's the one who called it. Now, when the council declared Gregory at Rome to be the true pope, this left only Benedict at Avignon. He met with Sigismund in 1416, but failed to accept the conciliar decision, was deposed in 1417. Now there was no pope, even at Rome. The council, under the direction of Sigismund, reformed the voting procedures and elected Martin V as Pope of Rome in November 1417, ending the schism. The Council of Constance also dealt with church reform and heresies. The most notorious event to occur at the council was the imprisonment, condemnation, and burning of John Huss, 1415. The next year, his close friend, Jerome of Prague, suffered the same fate. So, chart of the Western Schism. Following is a chart depicting the Western Schism and its related events. The popes at Rome who were involved were so forth. The line at Rome was backed by the German Empire, England, Hungary, Scandinavia, and most of Italy. The popes at Avignon involved were so on, and the line at Avignon was backed by France, Scotland, Spain, Sicily, Naples, and Savoy. The popes at Bologna, resulting from the council, were just two, Alexander, who died suddenly, and John the 23rd. Okay, so you look at the back page, and what you have here is the Babylonian captivity of the Roman popes at Avignon. There's seven of them. And then you have popes at Rome, popes at Avignon, popes at Bologna. That's from the Council of Pisa that tried to solve it in 1409. They elected Alexander, and he died suddenly after just 1 year. And then they elected a new guy, John the 23rd. So, Council of Constance removed three rival popes and elected Martin V in 1417, ending the schism. So you can see the line of popes at Bologna, there's just two of them, and John was deposed by his own council, he called. The popes at Avignon, Clement and Benedict, and then Benedict was deposed, and the popes at Rome, Urban, Boniface, Innocent, and Gregory, and he resigned. And then 1417, you can see Martin V, the Roman pope, he's elected, and that ends this period of competing popes. Yes?
You said that the popes at Rome, or the popes at Avignon were not accepted as popes.
Right, by the Roman Catholic Church.
That doesn't mean during the Babylonian captivity, though, does it?
No, it only means during this competing period. Okay, during the captivity, the official list of popes today includes those Avignon popes. Because at that time, there was only one pope. So, that's the story here, how they had several popes, and they refused to step down. They sent anathemas to each other and anathemas against the council, and new popes hurled anathemas back at each other. Now we want to talk about this Council of Constance, 1414. There were some things that happened that I want to talk about. The Council of Constance is a very interesting church council. It was called by John the 23rd, the Bologna Pope. And the reason, of course, was to solve this Western schism. The city of Constance in Germany is a very small city, even today. Then it had a population of 1,500, which is like Issaquah, Washington, or Marysville, or Enumclaw, or Ephrata, or Snohomish, or Bunky, Louisiana. I looked up some 5,500 population. Sturgis, South Dakota. Quitman, Georgia. Clive, Iowa. Sulphur, Oklahoma. Senatobia, Mississippi. Point Pleasant, West Virginia. Tulia, Texas. Moab, Utah. You know, Utah has all kinds of Bible names in it because of the Mormons. Blackjack, Missouri. Anyway, these type of little teeny towns. Now, you know, you've been to a little town like that. At the Council of Constance, when people arrived, there were 30,000 horses that came riding into the city. Over 100 princes, 108 counts, 200 barons, 1,500 knights. Now, 30,000 horses themselves can cause a lot of damage in a little town like that. One horse can cause a lot of damage to the ground, you know, if it's there very long, tromping around in the mud. They had tournaments, they had feasts, they had amusements arranged as relief. 500 minstrels came to sing ballads. Pope John the 23rd arrived with great pomp and ceremony. He had 9 cardinals and 1,600 mounted soldiers. 700 prostitutes did business in rented houses, plus myriads were in secret. Beggars, hawkers, thieves, and traffickers came all the way from the Orient, even, to pickpocket and steal things from these wealthy bishops, archbishops, cardinals, kings, princes, princesses. And the beautiful landscape of this small mountain town was ruined. It's estimated there were 100,000 people in the city of Constance. Now, it wasn't designed to hold this many people. The council lasted over 3.5 years, and these people lived here with giant chests of money. It was estimated 5,000 people rode in and out of town daily. They had 1,700 buglers. They had fiddlers and musicians. They had magicians, revelry, wickedness, dances, acrobatic shows, processions, musical displays. 500 people drowned in the lake during the time. This is an amazing thing, you know. They had 36,000 beds for strangers that were set up temporarily, and they said they would wash the linen 2 times a month. They had price ceilings fixed because prices would skyrocket due to need. 80,000 people watched Pope Martin V crowned the new Italian pope to solve the schism. When they got together, it took them 6 months to decide the first principle, and that is, votes would be by nations. Now, the reason was to overcome the 80 Italian bishops. There were so many of them, they would outvote any of the other ones. The cardinals wanted their own body of votes. It took a long time to get this rejected. Each nation met under its own president separately, and they had to agree until they knew which one pope their one vote would be cast for. They argued long over the voting principles. Tracts were circulated through the city asking for all three popes to be banned. Pope John finally agreed to step down if all the others would. A manuscript surfaced later, though, which uncovered the real reason John was willing to step down. And the manuscript says John was offered 30,000 ducats to step down. And so they were going to pay him off and have him step down. Charges were made of bribery. Rumors were that he would leave the council, and he talked about transferring the council to another location, but the tide seemed to be turning against John, who had called it. He promised not to leave town until the council ended. And the king of Germany, fearing John the 23rd would leave, gave orders to close the gates and watch the lake. Pope John escaped at high noon, riding on a little horse disguised as a groom during one of the big festival tournaments. There was panic when they realized the Pope had escaped from his own council. Pope John wrote letters to the French and to others that the council was unfair and the votes were unfair. He was hoping for asylum, perhaps. Marshals were sent out on horseback. They caught up with him, caught him escaping a month later. Sigismund's troops, the Roman Emperor's troops, brought him back. He agreed to accompany them back in the morning, and in the middle of the night, he was let down from the castle disguised as a peasant, and he got away again. And so John the 23rd was gone. The troops chased him again and recaptured him near Germany and brought him back to the council. The council forbade anyone else to leave under threat of excommunication. Now, they came voluntarily, you know, to help solve the problem. And now they're saying, you can't leave under the threat and so forth. See, these are not the way God's councils would be. The council stated it was acting on the leading of the Holy Spirit. And the council said that they were over everyone, including all the popes. The head of the University of Paris said, the gates of hell prevailed against the popes and against the church. See, he just thought, this thing is, you know, not of God at all. The council declared itself over all popes, and they put John the 23rd on trial for 70 different charges. These list of charges include almost every crime known to man. They include murder, adultery, sodomy, all kinds of wickedness. He was given to lying, it said, practiced simony, bought his way to the cardinal's office, sold the same benefices over and over. One of the charges was that this pope had sold the head of John the Baptist, which belonged to a group of nuns, for 50,000 ducats. It said that he wrote bulls, papal bulls, at whim, at the request of people for great sums of money, committed adultery with his brother's wife, violated nuns and virgins, practiced sodomy and other nameless devices. It said he was a heretic because he denied the future life, even. Now, this is the own council against the Pope. He was deposed in 1415 and condemned to perpetual imprisonment. But he secured his own release for 30,000 gulden and then was immediately appointed cardinal by the new pope, Martin V. Now, you know, this type of stuff is, it's wormy, isn't it? You know? He died 6 months later, though. and a splendid monument was erected to him by the Roman Catholic Church in the city of Florence, the great Pope John the 23rd. Why, if he's a heretic? Why, if he committed adultery and sodomy and murder and wrote bulls at request just for money and denied the future life? That guy's a heretic. Now we come to John Huss. He's the next man we want to talk about in our list of pre-Reformation characters. We bring him up because he was martyred at this Council of Constance. John Huss's dates are 1369 to 1415. And to find out how he got saved, we need to learn a fact. And that is, there was a marriage between the royal families of Bohemia, that's Czechoslovakia, and England. What happened was, Anne of Bohemia, Czechoslovakia, married Richard II of England. This united the two countries politically. And therefore, there was an interchange of scholars between Czechoslovakia and England. Many Bohemian men traveled to London and sat at the feet of John Wycliffe at Oxford University, and they learned the gospel there. These men eventually traveled back home to Bohemia. Bohemia is the same as Czechoslovakia. It's right here. It's in Central Eastern Europe. Here's Prague, Bohemia. This is where John Huss preached. He's from Prague. So these men came over here, they learned the gospel, and they went home. And many people in Czechoslovakia got saved and became Lollards. They became Wycliffeites, or gospel-believing people. Anne asked for the persecution to stop against the Lollards. And she's called Good Queen Anne of England. In Bohemia, the Christians were called Wycliffeites. I'm not sure they were called Lollards in their own land. I know they were called Wycliffeites. And the gospel movement took deeper root in Bohemia than it had in England. John Huss is known in history as the fifth evangelist. Now, by evangelist, we mean preacher of the gospel. You know how we have four gospels? And the word gospel in Greek is evangelizo. And so, to evangelize. It's the word gospel in Greek. And so you have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They are called the four evangelists or the four gospel writers. John Huss is the fifth gospel writer. He was ordained a priest in 1400 and appointed a preacher in the University of Prague. He was very famous in his country. He even became the court chaplain and minister to the queen, Sophia, over his nation. He was a very ardent supporter of John Wycliffe. Now, they never met each other. They never knew each other. Huss did not travel to England and study under him. Wycliffe died when Huss was only 12 years old. But he learned the gospel from these men who had met Wycliffe, and he preached against the corruption of the church. Did you notice in these movements, preaching against corruption is more popular than preaching the gospel? Now, why is this so? Craig? Mm-hmm. Yep. The Catholic Church was so corrupt, and there was no Protestant movement. The only thing they could do is try to reform their own church, since they didn't leave and start their own church. So they had to try to preach against the corruption in the church. Huss clashed with his archbishop in 1409. This is at the time of the Council of Pisa, which elected the Bologna Pope, you'll remember. 1409 at Pisa. Huss was in favor of the Council of Pisa to depose these two popes and elect a new one. The archbishop suspended John Huss from preaching in church. He ignored the rule and continued preaching anyway. Hus was excommunicated by his archbishop, and the city of Prague was placed under the interdict. Now, Hus continued preaching all over the country, regardless of this. While he was at the university, he defended Wycliffe's views, and many Roman Catholic clergy argued against him. In fact, the university declared 45 of his articles forbidden. He was appointed by the archbishop prior to his excommunication to investigate reports of miracles that had been done by a relic of Christ's blood. And so he investigated this Catholic relic, and his report condemned these miracles as a fraud. But the relic continued to bring comment at the universities until the 1500s. And so, a century later, it was still being believed in. What happened to this relic was a zealous Lutheran ran into the church, seized the relic, and threw it into the fire. That was the end of that relic. Anyway, Hus claimed the thing was a fraud. You know, we've seen these things in history before. They have bones and arms and fingers that quiver and twitch and bleed and things like that, you know, and perform miracles. The archbishop, so the city of Prague was placed under the interdict. There was a storm of protest by the nation and to the king and to the Vatican, and so the interdict and the excommunication were both lifted. The archbishop campaigned to burn Wycliffe's books. They'd been banned in the city of Prague. Hus protested to John the 23rd of the burning of his books on philosophy and logic. He argued in the letter, "Why don't you burn Aristotle's writings? Why don't you burn Origen's writings? They wrote on philosophy and logic." We say, good for you, Hus. He's arguing from reason. He was ignored, though. The Pope ordered Bohemia to be freed of heretics. This means slay all the Wycliffeites. The king ordered Hus to be allowed freedom to preach, though. So now there's a conflict. The Pope versus the king of Bohemia. Pope John the 23rd called Europe against the king of Naples, promising indulgences to the armies. In fact, they were sold in churches to try to recruit men. Hus lifted up his voice against this religious war and this abuse of the selling of indulgences. The Pope sent bulls to the city of Prague condemning these Wycliffeites and John Hus in particular. Two of Hus's students, who were gospel believers, stole the bulls. Now there's two of these papal letters, and they stole them. And so these university students drilled holes in the paper and tied it around their neck. They dressed up like harlots, two boys, and they got in a cart pulled by a donkey, and they went through town ridiculing the papal bulls from the harlot church. And at the center of town, they'd gathered a great crowd, and they burned the papal bulls. Now, the king heard this happened. He investigated. Three men were arrested and murdered, or killed, for abuse of the bulls. And this included the two boys who did it, plus somebody else. But all the people in the city of Prague viewed these men as martyrs for Christ. The agitation that all these events produced was not allayed when the Council of Constance assembled. The Emperor Sigismund requested his brother King Wenceslaus to send Hus to Constance. Wenceslaus is the king of Bohemia. And he promised him a safe conduct charge. Now, a safe conduct charge is a promise by a government official that we will send troops and escort you here so you won't be killed on the way, and we'll escort you home so you won't be killed on your return voyage. And, of course, it includes, we won't kill you while you're at the trial, you know. So that's a safe conduct charge or promise. The terms of the passport were very explicit. It required all of the emperor's subjects to allow the great Dr. Huss to pass and repass in full security. Huss readily obeyed the emperor's summons to the council. He'd always desired the opportunity of appealing to a general council. See, he thought, well, good. We'll call a church council, regular old general council, called by the Pope with all the bishops, and I'll argue for the gospel, and we'll turn the whole thing around. We'll all believe the truth. He hoped for a chance to preach at a general council. He arrived in Constance earlier than the emperor and was immediately brought before the Pope, John the 23rd, for examination. His doctrines were well known. But to his surprise, a long list of accusations was brought against him. And, since he refused to retract the charges, he was thrown in prison on the charge of heresy, notwithstanding the safe conduct promise of the Holy Roman Emperor Sigismund, the King of Germany. And in order to justify their flagrant breach of honor and pacify Sigismund, the bishops passed a decree, quote, "No faith ought to be kept with a heretic." And we say, wait a minute, this isn't fair. The king promised a safe conduct charge. They say, well, yeah, but we lied, and it's okay to lie to a heretic. That's really what they're saying. So he was betrayed by both the Pope and the king's safe conduct promise. Loud complaints were sent to the emperor from all over Bohemia. He received the first intimation of the imprisonment of Huss with indignation. He threatened to send Bohemian troops into the German city of Constance, break the prison open, and free Huss. But on reaching Constance, he was plied with arguments from canon law, urging that civil power did not extend to the protection of a religious heretic, and the treacherous priest absolved him from all responsibility. This is the king of Bohemia. He now allowed the enemies of Huss to take their course. So sad, huh? His own king wouldn't protect him. In the gloom of a loathsome dungeon, without a breath of fresh air, and harassed by priests and monks, the reformer became very ill. But the deluded emperor cared for none of these things. Pope John, as we said, escaped, but was caught in Switzerland and brought back a prisoner. But unlike his victim Huss, he was conscience-stricken, without honor, without dignity, and without courage. Robert Hallam, Bishop of Salisbury, at the head of the English, in a burst of righteous indignation, declared that a pope so covered with crime deserved to be burned at the stake. He was taken to the castle of Gottleben, where the good John Huss had been pining in irons for some months. There, Pope John languished until the close of the session, which was nearly 4 years. But after humbling himself at the feet of the reigning pontiff, he was raised to the rank of a cardinal and permitted to close his days in peace. But no such leniency was exercised toward the righteous man of God and blameless reformer, John Huss. In the first movement of his trial, the Archbishop of Prague instituted a vigilant search for the translation of Wycliffe's writings, having collected about 200 books, many of them richly bound and decorated with precious ornaments. He caused them to be publicly burned in the marketplace at Prague. Much was said as to the identity of the doctrines of Huss with those of Wycliffe, which the council condemned as heretical under 45 propositions, and decreed that his bones should be taken out of their grave and burned. Huss was also charged with being, quote, infected with the leprosy of the Waldenses, close quote. Under these two general heads, Wycliffeism and Waldensism, and a vast number of other charges grossly offensive to the hierarchy were contained. The council, although bent on the destruction of Huss, would willingly have avoided the scandal of a public trial. Certain passages which his enemies had extracted from his writings were thought sufficient for his condemnation without a trial. Now, you like that? Condemned to death without a trial? See, how would you feel if it was you? Okay, we'll pick up the story of John Huss right there. We just have a couple more things to study, and then we'll be done up to 1517, and we'll take a test up through that period. Right. We're going to study Huss and Savonarola and Erasmus, and we'll be done. Can you explain real quick?